Good morning. It's good to see you. Good to see some who have been away at school and away doing their thing and back with us this morning. Glad to see you. If you have your Old Testament, please take it out and turn over to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37. This morning we're going to talk about Joseph, and it's one of those lessons that some of the younger kids really like because it only has one point to it. We have a one-point lesson today, and we'll get to that one point here in just a little while. But before we do that, we want to review Joseph's life just a little bit, kind of remind ourselves of some things about Joseph. He's one of those Old Testament characters that when we think about him, we can't help but be impressed. He doesn't come to our mind first like some of them do. For example, Noah and Abraham and Moses, they tend to get more press than Joseph. But when we stop and think about Joseph, we can't help but be impressed with him. We're introduced to him in Genesis chapter 37. Here's what it says in verse 2. It says, Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report to them about to their father. It says in verse 3, Now Israel, that is his father, loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. You remember the story now, don't you? Joseph was the fella who was hated by his brothers. It's a hard thing for us to comprehend. It's a hard thing for us to get in our minds. We need to think back, though, about his family. He had a strange family to begin with, and they were all kind of mixed in there. And I'm convinced, because of the age difference between them and all of that, they didn't view themselves as brothers like they should have. They had issues with each other, and what did not help at all is the fact that they all knew that the father loved Joseph more than all the other brothers. A strange thing, an odd thing, and something that should never, ever be. But that's the way it was. And so, you know how the story goes. It says in verse 5, Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. And the dream was that ultimately his brothers were going to be bowing down to him. Ultimately, that's the way it would all work out. And they didn't like it one bit. It says in verse 8 again, So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. They just really did not like their little brother, Joseph. And so, as the story continues, down in verse 18 of chapter 37, it says, When they, that would be his brothers, when they saw him from a distance and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. That's one of those understatements in the text. It is stated as if it is not a big deal. It is an unbelievable thing. It is hard for us to imagine. And really it harkens back in our mind, back over to Genesis chapter 4, when Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. It's hard, again, for us to understand that kind of hatred, that kind of meanness, that kind of an attitude towards someone that you're supposed to love, you're supposed to take care of, and you're supposed to encourage. But they say in verse 19, Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams. They have a pretty good plan to get rid of Joseph, their little brother. Again, an amazing thing. Reuben has a little bit of conscience about him. It says in verse 21, But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, Let us not take his life. Let's not kill him. As if there's, you know, we're kind of on the bubble here, and so let's not do that. Let's go in a different direction. He says in verse 22, Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him. And he said this that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to their father. Reuben has at least a good heart wanting to help Joseph. It has always been interesting to me why he did not rise up and say, Wait a minute, we're not going to do any of this. We're going to get our attitudes right. We're going to treat him like we should. But he didn't do that. What he did is commendable, but it is not commendable enough. And so you know how the story goes. They throw him into a pit. It says in verse 25, Then they sat down to eat a meal, and as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood?" An interesting question, isn't it? What profit is it for us? In other words, that's not going to do us any good. Oh, we're going to do it. We're mad at him. We don't like him. We're going to do it. But there's no profit in that for us. We don't get much out of that, at least long term. And so he says in verse 27, "Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listen to him. What do you make of that? Has Judah said, "Okay, you know, what we're going to do now is we're going to sell him because he's our flesh and blood. We can't kill him." Is that his attitude? Or is his attitude really more of a, you know, "He's our flesh and blood and I'd like to get some money out of him before we get rid of him, so let's do it that way"? A lot of folks wonder about that. A lot of folks are willing to argue about that. It doesn't make me a whole lot of difference where you settle on that. Whether his intention is good and he really wants to rescue him, or whether he just wants some money out of the deal, doesn't make me a lot of difference, because he, just like Reuben, should have been one to stand up and say, "What we're doing altogether is wrong and we need to stop it." And he didn't do that. And so verse 28, then some Midianite traders passed by. So they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. That's how we are introduced to Joseph and his brothers. They sold him into Egyptian slavery, as we say. It's exactly what they did. And as strange to us as that is, we find out later on that it's God's will that it be that way. Okay? Is it God's will that his brothers be mean to him and hate him and mistreat him? Absolutely not. What it means is God is using all of that, and he's using the attitude, the bad attitude of those brothers, he is using that to bring about his own purposes. And so if you'll skip over to chapter 39, we see a little bit about Joseph while he is in Egypt. It says in verse 1, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there." And verse 2 says, "The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian." Verse 3 says, "Now his master saw that the Lord was with him, and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant, and he made him overseer over his house and all that he owned." Look down at verse 6. "So he," Potiphar, "left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, and with him there he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate." The Lord was with Joseph. We again understand that this is God's will. It is not God's will that his brothers mistreat him and sell him. It is God's will that God uses that to bring about a greater purpose. And that's what God is going to do. And so even Potiphar, the Egyptian in charge of Pharaoh's bodyguard, which I would think would be a high-level position and a much trusted position, even Potiphar sees that Joseph is special. And so Potiphar puts him in charge of all of his house. There's nothing that he's not in control of. All Potiphar worries about is what he's going to eat today. And then the text records for us in the middle of verse 6, "Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance." And it says that for a reason. That's because Potiphar's wife is going to make overtures toward Joseph. It says in verse 7, "It came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, 'Lie with me.' But he refused and said to his master's wife, 'Behold, with me here my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge.'" He goes on in verse 9 and says, "There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?" Verse 10 says, "As she spoke to Joseph day after day, he did not listen to her to lie beside her or be with her." It's hard to imagine the circumstance the young man was in. It's really hard to envision that. But you have Joseph here as a servant in the house, and day after day, this woman is after him. Day after day. It's constant. And his reply always is, "Absolutely not. Will not even consider it," because of what your master has done for me and the position he's given me, and because I will not do this against God. He understands that that kind of sin and any sin is against God, and he says, I'm not going to do that. It goes beyond and above Potiphar, so he's not going to do it. And then you know what happens. She falsely accuses him. She screams out, grabs some of his clothing. He is ultimately then imprisoned for doing absolutely nothing. It says in verse 20, so Joseph's master took him and put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he was there in jail. And then not surprisingly, verse 21, but the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. We find out that Joseph became the highest level prisoner in the jail. And the chief jailer really relied on him. Well, to move down through the story some, pretty soon some of Pharaoh's employees find themselves there, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, verse 2 of chapter 40. And they ultimately have a dream and have dreams, and Joseph is able to tell them what the dreams mean. One of them turns out pretty good, one of them does not. And so to the one whose dream turns out pretty good, Joseph says in verse 14, you look at verse 14 of chapter 40, he says, only keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing that they should have put me into this dungeon. So he states for the very first time in verse 15 kind of a summation of his circumstance. He says, I don't belong in this prison. I haven't done anything to get me in here. And in fact, how I even got here is not right. I was kidnapped, and that's the way I even got here. Now, the kidnappers, of course, were his brothers, not the Midianite traders, the Ishmaelites. But that's what he says. He kind of sums up his circumstance there. And so you'd think that when things went well, he would be remembered. But it says in verse 23, the last verse of chapter 40, yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Well, as the story goes on, you know that Joseph is finally called on to tell Pharaoh what his dreams mean. Joseph does that. He is able to tell Pharaoh what's going to happen. And Pharaoh was so impressed with that he puts Joseph in charge. And Joseph does well there also. And ultimately, his whole family comes to Egypt. And they come because of the famine. They come because God put Joseph in that circumstance so he was able to kind of save Egypt from the famine. And that's when the reuniting of Joseph and his family occurs. And it looks like everything's going to be just fine. And Joseph then says that you meant this for evil to his brothers. You were doing me harm. You were not treating me fairly, but God meant it for good. That's Joseph's perspective on it all. Now, with all that said, with kind of an overview of Joseph's life, we want to get down to the one lesson. There's only one, so you probably need to get it. Just one lesson. So here's the one lesson. Life is not about your circumstances. It is about how you handle your circumstances. We'll say that one lesson another way. Life is not about the things that happen to you. It is how you deal with the things that happen to you. When we look back at the life of Joseph, we see that it all fits together and ties together because we hear Joseph say at the end, God meant it for good. God was involved in all this. We see God blessing Joseph when he is in prison. We see God blessing Joseph when he is in Potiphar's house. We see God taking care of Joseph over and over and over again. And so visually, we understand that it's not about Joseph's circumstances. It's about how he handles his circumstances. And it's really easy to see that because we see God's divine intervention in Joseph's life. It's more difficult with our own lives, because many times we are not able to see ongoingly God's providence in our lives. And so it becomes more difficult for us to remember that it's not about our circumstances, it's about how we react to and how we handle our circumstances. I'll tell you what, young folks need to learn that lesson. Lots of times young folks have trouble with a teacher at school. They don't like a certain teacher, or they think a certain teacher's been unfair, or whatever they think. And so the whole attitude changes toward that teacher, and sometimes about the whole school process. Everything turns sour because you think one person has done you wrong. And what Joseph's life says is it doesn't matter that your teacher may or may not have done you wrong. It doesn't make any difference. What matters is how you react to that. There's lots of ball players that get upset with their coaches because things don't go the way they want them to go. Maybe they don't get the kind of playing time they want. Maybe they don't get to play the position they want to play. And so they get a bad attitude toward the coach. And all of a sudden they become ineffective on the team and they pull the rest of the team down. And everything just continues in a downward slide. What we need to learn from the life of Joseph is it's not about your circumstance. It's not about whether a coach is fair or not. It's about how you react to that. Now we're going somewhere with this, so hold on with me. It happens to us when we get to be adults as well, you know. Maybe somebody doesn't say the right thing to us when we go to work one morning. Maybe what they said is offensive to us. It really hurts us. What are we going to do about that? Now we have a bad attitude toward that person and a wall is going to be built and now there's going to be internal strife within the company and we're going to really have problems? No. From the life of Joseph, we learn it's not about those circumstances, it's not about those situations, it's about how we react to those things. There's not a one of us who's been alive a little while who doesn't understand that life isn't fair. Life is not fair. It's not going to be fair tomorrow or the next day. And if what you're waiting for is for your life to be fair, where everybody treats you the way you ought to be treated and all of that, if you're waiting for that, that's never going to happen. And by the way, that's really ultimately not something we want, because the very last thing I want and the last thing you want is for God to be fair in the end. We don't want fair. Life's not going to be fair. We're not surprised by that. And yet we get our feelings hurt and we get ourselves turned around when something doesn't go our way, thinking that it's supposed to fit me. It's supposed to be what I want. It's not going to be that way for us. It's about how we handle the circumstances that life deals us. And don't ever think that because I'm a Christian, because I'm trying to do God's will, I'm going to somehow be protected from the unfairness of life. That's not going to happen. Now, I'll tell you this, the life of a Christian is filled with hope, and that hope is an anchor of the soul, and that hope makes us where we can stand it, and we can deal with it, and we can handle it. But don't ever think that the life of a Christian is going to be an easy life. That's what Joseph is screaming to us. I understand Joseph wasn't a Christian in the New Testament sense, but he was a young man trying to do what God wanted him to do, and that did not at all make him immune from the difficulties of life. In fact, in many cases, and according to the Lord, it will make life even harder. Jesus, the Son of God, said, "I don't have a place to lay my head at night." You want to follow me? Get comfortable with that. That's what Jesus says. And so what we need to do as people trying to be the people of God is we need to get rid of this notion that says life needs to be fair and life needs to be good. We need to get rid of that and understand that sometimes it's not going to be, but what matters is how we handle that. And you might be thinking to yourself, "Oh, I do a good job of that. I handle life just fine." I hope so. But you know, a part of handling life is handling when other people don't meet our expectations. And you put yourself in Joseph's place in Potiphar's house. Have you ever read through that story and thought, you know, Potiphar should have believed Joseph? Joseph could have said, "I've been serving Potiphar. I've done everything Potiphar wanted me to do. I've never made fun of Potiphar's funny name. I have always been good to Potiphar." Joseph could have said that. And he could have said, "Potiphar put me in this prison, and he wasn't supposed to do that, and I was innocent." And he could have had a really, really bad attitude toward Potiphar. There's no indication of that at all. Joseph handled his circumstances. And that's what Christians have to do. Not with an arrogant attitude that says, "I've got my life under control, what's wrong with the rest of you people?" That's not it at all. And we don't return kindness only when we receive kindness. If we're going to live that way, then life's really going to be rough for us, because ultimately nobody's going to extend much kindness to us. The lesson we've got to learn is life's not going to be fair. Life's going to be difficult. And how we respond to the difficulties of life is what's most important. Turn with me over to Ephesians in chapter 5. Ephesians in chapter 5. In Ephesians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul begins the chapter looking back to what he said before, of course, but he begins chapter 5 and verse 1 by saying, "Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma." One of the things that we find out about God, and in passages like Philippians chapter 2 and others, we find out that God has done marvelous things for us in spite of the way we've acted. God has done good things for us in spite of the way we've acted. Because whatever it is that Joseph could have said about his brothers and about Potiphar and about the folks who forgot about him and left him in prison, whatever he could have said about those people, and whatever you or I can say about the people who we think have been unfair to us in this life, whatever we could say about those people does not begin to compare with what God could say about us and our response and reaction to him. You see, none of us have measured up to what God has required on our own. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. What's almost humorous about that is that in light of that passage and that knowledge that everybody has the sin problem, what we do is we then turn our evil eye on everyone else and we pick everyone else apart and say, "Yeah, but this person did me wrong and this person didn't live up to my expectations and this person let me down." We look at all these other people who have done these terrible things in our mind, but none of that compares to what we ourselves have done to our Creator. What we have to get in our head is we're all the same. Life's not fair for any of us. And the people who are doing really well today need to keep working really hard tomorrow. But the end result is what Paul calls us to do in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 1, is be imitators of God, not be the best people we can be, and not be better than our neighbors, and not be better than the people who sit beside us in church, but be imitators of God. That's the standard. That's the thing to which we're called. And so if we are imitators of God, then how do we react when someone mistreats us? How do we react when someone lets us down? How do we respond to that like God does? How does God respond to us when we let Him down? "For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him should not perish but have everlasting life." That's how God responds to people who let Him down. That's how God responds to people who don't treat Him in a fair manner. That's who God is. And so when Paul says be imitators of God, he is not saying be good people and be nice. That's not what he's saying. He is saying understand how you're going to treat other people, not based on how they've treated you, but based on who God is. I don't know of a passage that sets the bar any higher than Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 1. The Apostle Paul will say in 2 Corinthians 11, be imitators of me. But here, this goes even further. Be imitators of God. Act like God. Look like God. Have you ever thought that it could possibly in some way be possible for someone to see God in us? Isn't that amazing? You'll note that verse 1 starts with a therefore, and we have said many, many times that any time there is a therefore, we have to figure out what it is there for. It is referring back to something. It is summing something up. It is making a point based on other information. And the other information that the point is being made on is this. You started the new life. You became a Christian. You're different than you used to be. That's the point. And so therefore, since you started the new life, since you put on Christ, since you have become different by choice, since you've chosen this new life, be imitators of God. Listen, what that does is it takes away all the concern about fairness. And you'll never ever, listen to me young folks, you'll never ever again walk home with a horror or get home with a horrible day saying somebody wasn't fair to me or somebody said something that hurt my feelings or somebody did this or that and my day's just ruined. Your day is never going to be ruined if you're imitators of God. There'll be times when you're sad. There'll be times when things aren't going the way you want them to go. But you will always, always understand that it's how you respond to that that matters. It's where you go from here. In fact, that's what life is. Life is about where do I go from here? What do I do when people I love let me down? What do I do about that? The same thing God did about that. It's a hard, hard thing for us. It's a difficult thing. And so when he says, be imitators of God as beloved children, and follows that up with this, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us. What that says is when the people you love let you down, sacrifice yourself even more for them. When people you count on do not come through, give even more of yourself to them. When a relationship is not what it ought to be, think first of all, can I give more to that relationship to make it better? We live in a world that likes to lay blame in other places, and I can be pretty good at that myself. Be imitators of God. Is that what God does? Is that what He does? Is He characterized by laying blame elsewhere? Or is He characterized by loving His creation and doing whatever He can to help His creation? It is that to which we are called. It may be better if we change our focus regarding life. And instead of view life as something that is for ourselves, that is for us, and that we should enjoy and all that, maybe we should view life as a series of plan Bs, you know, as a series of alternates. Understanding that it is never going to go the way we want it to go. It is never going to all be lined up successively and work just perfectly. There's always going to be some sort of an issue. There's always going to be something to deal with. And so we then get our mindset ready to handle the difficulties. We don't get our feelings hurt. We're not people characterized by being offended all the time. We're people who are like God. We're striving to do good for others, no matter if they've done good to us or not. And if they've let us down, we're going to encourage them even more because we want to help them. I'll leave you with this thought. In the last day, when we all stand before the judgment seat of Christ, the Apostle Paul called it, when we are there, I don't believe the questions that we are asked, if we are asked any, will have to do with, did you have a happy life? Did everything go your way? The end of it all is going to boil down to this. How did we respond to what happened to us? How did we respond to what happened? When you think about what the Lord said in Matthew chapter 7 about the wise man and the foolish man, the wise man built his house on the rock and it withstood the difficulties of life. The foolish man did not, and it did not. Implied in that story are the difficulties of life, the storms of life. You see, that's what we're talking about. That's what Joseph was involved in. That's what you and I many times are involved in. That's life. And if we could characterize life, that's the way we do it ultimately. A series of storms, of things that come and go, of difficulties that come and go that we have to handle. And the wise man there, he built his life on the rock. What is that? Well, that's the Lord and His promises and His Word. Be imitators of God, Ephesians 5:1. If you're a Christian, we want to encourage you this morning, don't get sidetracked by the difficulties of life. Don't get sidetracked by the things that are difficult. Don't expect things to be perfect. They're not always going to be perfect. But understand that how you respond to them is what really matters. When the story of Joseph is over, did God take care of Joseph? Yes, He did. And you have the same assurance. Be imitators of God. If you're not a Christian, we want to encourage you to become a Christian. Because it is in Christ where the real blessings are found. It is in Christ where the blessing of the hope of heaven is found. And if you have not put on Christ in baptism, you need to do that. That's the starting point. You need to become a Christian. And then you live your life as best you can, being an imitator of God. It won't always be easy. It'll be real hard sometimes, and you'll fail like the rest of us do. But you'll keep trying. Because it is worth it in the end. Can we help you this morning? Is there anything we can do for you? Let's stand and sing.